this reminds me of my first experience in radio. It was back in the early 80s.
People with disability and mental health.
There's always controversy with us.
The mysteries of the mind and consciousness.
And we might get to the bottom of something, or we might start something new.
We're going to run the gamut and we're going to have a good time.
Waking Braves. No, not Waking Braves. We're Breaking Waves.
Breaking Waves?
Breaking Waves.
Breaking Waves.
We are back with another episode of Breaking Waves. I'm Riley.
And I'm John. And today we're going to talk about iconic movies, a bit of a follow-on from last week.
That's right. And I think you know that a movie is really iconic if before you ever saw the film, you were aware of a lot of the famous parts of it by being portrayed in like other movies or cartoons. You know, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is a good example of that because a long time before I saw the film, of course, I knew that music because it gets referenced in so many other things. That's it. And this phenomenon has been going on for a very long time in entertainment. I mean, if you go back and watch old Warner Brothers, like Looney Tunes cartoons, they're making all sorts of references to Humphrey Bogart and Bing Crosby and all the big kind of popular cultural things of that time.
Back to your cage, boy.
And then nowadays we've got things like Family Guy, you know, doing the same thing, so.
I guess it all started off with libraries full of books and different sections of the library.
Yes.
Went on from there.
And we were thinking about the idea of genre. So the word genre is a French word meaning kind, style, with an origin from the Latin word type, which of course, as you say, John, it all leads back to the Greeks.
So it means a category. And we're all familiar with the streaming sites that have, you know, the movie listings at the top with the different categories, the different genres.
You know, there's certain genres that, like what we were saying last week, there's certain genres that go out of favor. For example, westerns and pirate movies like swashbucklers, sword and sandal, those kind of things are less popular than they were half a century ago. And then there's like, sometimes there's like new subgenres that pop up.
Yeah, genres within genres. You know, all the different kinds of horror movies.
Yeah, there's a lot of those. The idea of something being genre-defining, I would say, when you look at something like The Good and the Bad and the Ugly, what it does is, it wasn't the first Western, obviously, and not the first spaghetti Western, but because at the time, people looked upon spaghetti Westerns as being inferior, but this movie really was a classic in its own right, and transcended the perceived limitations of the genre. And I would go so far as to say that it could be the most iconic Western. Certainly for me as a child, before I'd ever watched a Western movie, The Good, the Bad, the Ugly was the first Western that I was really aware of because it's just so much in the zeitgeist. It is so iconic, that music, the Clint Eastwood character. That opening where they have the good, the bad, and the ugly, I remember that blew my mind as a kid as well because it's like so cartoonish. But yeah.
And that's, yeah, a lot of spaghetti westerns are like that.
Yes.
They're quite cartoon-like. And as we mentioned last week, the characters are sort of cartoon-like characters. They're sort of, they're archetypes of people or generalizations of
these heroes, these villains, and those in between. I guess, yeah, so for something to be genre-defying, it has to be, I guess, what is most associated with the genre. So, for example, something like Jaws is the ultimate shark movie. The Godfather is the ultimate crime, family, gangster-type movie, you know?
And The Matrix is the ultimate franchise of cyberpunk.
That's right.
William Gibson-esque, Bruce Sterling.
Yeah, so
type stories.
And these movies don't have to be the first progenitors of the genre, but what they have to do is, like, a lot of the time they'll, as we said, they'll take the stuff that's already, there's already a foundation there, because those William Gibson books came out 15 years before The Matrix.
Early 80s, yeah.
But
yeah, he was way before the internet even existed, which is quite amazing, because they didn't date at all as far as the storyline and the characters and the plot and everything.
If anything, they become more relevant, right?
Yeah, they're just fantastic insight into the changes that the world, the Gibson-esque world, the cyberpunk world, is very similar to the world we're in now with the internet and corporate everything. That was very much the world in those three books that he wrote, Neuromancer, Mona Lisa Overdrive, and the other one.
Count Zero.
Count Zero, that's it. Now, I think there are some genres which are really defined by the actor, not by the character. You know, like Arnold Schwarzenegger, he kind of plays the same kind of character. Well, he's gone outside the box a few times, but Bruce Willis, Charles Bronson.
Yeah, yeah.
Played the tough guy.
Chuck Norris is another one. And then in the modern era, I guess the last of that kind of style of action hero would probably be Statham. He's a holdover.
And Liam Neeson, who's now an action type tough guy.
Yeah.
In the last 5 years.
Yeah, that's right. He's, it's funny because he didn't become an action star until he was like in his mid-50s with Taken, and now that's all he seems to do. But like before that, he was like a serious dramatic actor. And then other people start off as the action type dude when they're younger and they branch out. So yeah, people have different trajectories. But you mentioned as well, John, how there's filmmakers who really make types of films that are just incomparable to a point where they're a genre in of themselves. So like Fellini movies, I would put Bergman in there, Ingmar Bergman movies as well. Kurosawa is another one. I know that there's samurai, but like that he just did it in a way that's what you think of when you think of samurai. You
and
know,
so. Some American filmmakers as well. The guy that did Rumblefish, who was it?
Well, that was actually Coppola.
Coppola, yeah. It was one of his, or his first.
And he did, what's the name?
Apocalypse Now? Didn't he do Apocalypse Now?
Yeah, well, he did the Godfather, and yeah, he did The Outsider. So he did a couple of those based off those books by S.C. Hinton. But Rumblefish and The Outsiders are like very iconic as far as...
Yeah, they had kind of a surreal, unreal kind of vibe to the scenes, like lots of smoke.
Yeah.
Like fog, unexplained fog in the streets, and, you know, some of those scenes with Tom Waits in the diner.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, there'd been a lot of movies about gangs and marauding youth before that and stuff from, like, back in the day, but the way that...
Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah, and The Wild One with Brando. But the way that Coppola did it for Rumblefish and The Outsider... Well, Rumblefish in particular is very artistic, and so that's kind of, I think, more synonymous than even the stuff that came before. I think it's interesting as well how sometimes when we think of a certain movie, we might actually kind of misremember what we associate with it could be from the sequel. I can think of some examples of this, like the Pink Panther, which I guess is a genre-defining thing for the sort of bumbling detective genre, shall we say. So the Pink Panther, everyone knows the Pink Panther, that Pink Panther in the credits who got his own animated series, but also the Pink Panther music. Insert music. But like, when you go back and watch that first Pink Panther movie, it's really nothing like what the franchise would become and what people would associate with Pink Panther. Because the first one is much more of an ensemble film. And it's kind of like a... You know, Peter Sellers playing Inspector Clouseau is in it. but he's kind of just like this random detective who's investigating this jewel thievery, but it's really dealing with a lot of other characters, and it's not that funny, the first one. It's more kind of like a lot of frivolous, star-powered type movies that they made in the 60s, which were quite vapid, you know. But then when you watch the second Pink Panther movie, A Shot in the Dark, that's when they introduce Herbert Lom as the guy that despises him, his like nemesis and stuff. And that second Pink Panther movie is actually what people really think about when they think about Pink Panther. So sometimes the sequel, in rare occasions, ends up being more iconic. But then in your head, people just kind of go, "Oh, it's Pink Panther," you know.
Yeah, I think it's pretty common for them to get worse as these franchises go on, but not always. The Matrix was a bit like that for me.
Yeah.
The first one was great, and it went a bit weird for me.
Yeah, same.
I didn't even bother watching those old ones. And the latest one, I don't think I can get all over it. I got all the way through it.
And there's rare occasions when you get a first movie and a sequel that are both iconic in their own right, but in different ways. And I would say that Terminator is that, because the first Terminator movie came out in 1984, and it's obviously got a very 80s vibe. And the first Terminator, when you go back and watch it again, it's really like a horror movie. It has this very like doom-laden atmosphere, and it's a bit like a slasher film, the way that he'll just like appear and kill people. Whereas the sequel, Terminator 2, which came out 8 years later in 1992, and is much more 90s, it's got a different aesthetic, a different tone. Terminator 2 is more of the sort of epic type action movie. And it's quite different, but like, it's debatable about which of those two movies is better, but it's a very like worthy sequel. And then you've got Alien. And Aliens, that's kind of another one as well, where the first Alien is just much more of a horror thriller kind of thing, where there's just the one alien and Sigourney Weaver squaring off on the ship. But then Aliens is like this full-on like military action movie type of thing, which is once again like great in its own right and filled with iconic moments like the "Game over, man, game over, we're done." But yes, you're right, John, they do often get worse. You know, if you look at something like Jaws 2, there's a big drop-off in quality. I think the biggest drop-off that I've ever seen in quality from a first movie to the second movie would be Exorcist 2. I think that's, like, the most insane... Like,
I don't remember the second one. I think they've actually just made another Exorcist movie recently.
They did, yes. Yeah. It was not good. but the new one was just really dull. Whereas the Exorcist 2, which I think came out in 1977, that was like...
Wow, that was just huge.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that there'd been anything quite like that.
That's right. And I guess this kind of brings us into horror a bit, because Exorcist 2 is the ultimate iconic possession movie. And I think you're right, John. I don't think there'd been anything like it before. I mean, you had sort of satanic horror stuff kind of before that, but nothing that went so deep into this idea of possession. And then when you watch other movies about possession, even stuff that comes out more recently, like we had The Pope's Exorcist with Russell Crowe. When you watch, like, even modern Exorcist films, you still see the influence of that 1971 film.
Yeah, absolutely. Like The Godfather. That's
yes.
Kind of echoed in so many other...
Yeah.
That telling of that classic American, Italian...
Yes.
...family, the culture of the organisation and the setting and everything is echoed through time.
Do you personally, John, put The Shawshank Redemption in a category of iconic?
I don't know. I never really thought about it in that way. It's a jail movie, so there's a category.
Yes.
Genre. There's been plenty of those. Dudes locked up in jail. Remember that one with Robert Redford in it?
Yeah.
All kinds of stories about...
The Last Castle, was it? Yeah. Shawshank was an interesting case because when it came out, it was a commercial failure at the box office, but it ended up becoming discovered on VHS, on home video, and it gained this real popularity.
Why would have that have been a failure, do you think? Because it's actually it's quite an engaging film. It's a good story. It ticks all the boxes.
I don't know. Maybe it didn't have good marketing behind
maybe
it.
Maybe that's it.
But yeah, it found new life on video and cable television.
Yeah, that was a bit of a different time back then. The whole the process of producing a film and getting it out there is totally changed now. Mm. It's in music, it's changed, and it's changed in the movie world as
yeah.
well. It's not about cinemas anymore.
Yeah, straight to streaming. Drawing back to the horror realm, a genre that's been very popular for the last 44 years, I guess, is the slasher genre. But if we want to kind of trace back the movie that perhaps started it all, it would be Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, which came out in 1960. And it was a groundbreaking movie in a lot of ways, but it really, it's like this exploration of this character who, he's a real psycho, and the use of suspense, it did things in a way that was really shocking and new, and it still holds up. What kind of impression did Psycho make on you, John? Like, when did you first watch it?
Well, the music.
Oh, of course.
That screeching orchestral.
Yes.
Music and score behind it.
By Bernard Herrmann. The, if you want to talk about iconic, I mean, the music from Psycho, the shower scene, Norman Bates. It's amazing to, I love to imagine, like, what would it be like for someone from back in 1960 going into that movie and not knowing anything about the story? Because when you first meet the villain of the movie, played by Anthony Perkins, he seems like this very mild-mannered, gentle guy, wouldn't hurt a fly, you know? And I love to imagine, like, you can tell there is something creepy going on, but you don't necessarily know that it's him at the start. But I love to imagine watching that movie and being like, oh, you know, he seems quite sweet, you know, and then, like, the way that it goes. But so then it takes a while for... there's other kind of slashes in the 60s, like Peeping Tom, but we don't really get the more groundwork laid until the 70s. 74 is a big year, but we get Black Christmas, but much more iconic and important is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, directed by Tobe Hooper, super low budget, and it's actually much less gruesome than people remember. So much.
It's pretty gruesome. I remember the chairs made out of human limbs. That was pretty gruesome.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, as far as like on screen, like death and blood and stuff, it's...
Well, they had their budget constraints.
Yeah, yeah. But terrific film in terms of, yeah, the suspense, the griminess, the atmosphere. And then 4 years later in 1978, we get John Carpenter's Halloween, which introduces us to this slasher, this killer called Michael Myers. Apparently the mask that he wears in that movie was a William Shatner mask painted white. But that's just a little bit of trivia there. But Halloween really kick-started. Without Halloween, we don't get the Jason movies and the Freddy movies and everything that came after. Halloween was a huge hit, and... It's funny because I was looking into the first Friday the 13th movie, which is the Jason series. Although, spoiler alert, in the first movie, it's actually Jason's mother is the killer. And Jason just makes a cameo at the end, but he doesn't even get the hockey mask till the third movie. But this is another example of the first movie not being what people associate with the culture around it. But anyway, I was reading up on it, and apparently the writers and director of Friday the 13th were very consciously trying to cash in on the success of Halloween and make something like that. So we got this whole slew of slasher films in that
time. Well, that's kind of like another role of the whole genre thing, is that you get an audience, a certain audience that expect a certain thing. And if you sell the film when you're trying to market it and release it in a certain way, you're going to attract that audience,
yes,
that category of people that like horror movies or kung fu movies or, you know, war movies or whatever.
It's kind of crazy to me because the Halloween franchise is still going on. I think we're about 14 movies into it at this point. Like one of them, there was a new Halloween movie came out last year. Or I think it was the year before, actually, 2022. But I'm actually quite surprised that there haven't been any Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street movies for about 14 years. But a big franchise today as far as the slashers is the Scream movies. And the first Scream movie came out in 1996. It was directed by Wes Craven, who also did Nightmare on Elm Street. So he's done a lot of iconic horror movies. But the thing that made Scream special and I think makes it a series that's very resonant for millennial generation, like my generation, is that it was kind of the first really big horror movie to be satirical about the genre itself and make fun of itself and make references to other horror movies. And so it works as like both a comedy, as a really well-made horror movie, but also a satire on the genre itself and the cliches of the genre. And they're still making Scream movies. And I think the thing that makes Scream enduringly popular is that so that's the one with the ghost faced killer in the hood with the white ghost mask. It kind of looks like the Scream, kind of with the big open mouth. But the thing with the Scream movies is that they are mysteries because it's a different killer, it's a different person behind the mask in each film. So it's kind of this like unveiling that happens, and that means that they don't have to keep resurrecting the same villain. It can be a different villain donning the look each time, and so I think that gives Scream more of an enduring nature. Like it really could just go on forever. But as far as like other more specific horror subgenres, another one I've written down is folk horror. Are you familiar with folk horror, John?
You have to give me an example.
Well, the ultimate folk horror movie is The Wicker Man.
We confer upon you a rare gift these days, a martyr's death. You will not only have life eternal, but you will sit with the saints among the elect. Come. It is time to keep your appointment with The Wicker Man.
And so it's folk horror is like the pagan type horror. These like pagan cults of like witches and druid type people doing sacrifices in the wilderness and these kind of things. And after The Wicker Man, there was a lot of other movies cashing in. Nothing really rose to that level of success, but I guess Midsommar would be a more recent example of it. Yeah, the Wicker Man was a big phenomenon. As far as zombie movies, now, zombie movies have been around for a long time, but zombies did not become what we think of as zombies until the late 60s.
They kind of started out in Haiti.
That's right, John.
With
voodoo.
Chicken giblets.
Yeah.
And the consumption of psychoactive substances and then subsequent writhing around and bizarre behavior and raising of the dead in some way.
Yeah, when you go back and look at the old zombie movies.
And there was a Bond one that had those themes.
That's right, Live and Let Die. So the old zombie movies were very much associated with this Haitian voodoo thing.
Yeah, voodoo.
A lot of the time, it wasn't even about, like in the old black and white type zombie movies of the 30s and 40s, it was more about people being sort of entranced and controlled by voodoo to become like these kind of slaves, rather than about people rising up off the ground and eating flesh and that kind of thing. That doesn't start until the late 60s, 1968, with George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, which is a great independent, like, black and white horror movie. Really, the most iconic is his follow-up to it 10 years later with Dawn of the Dead, which is the one in the shopping mall. And it's not even my personal favorite of his films, because he did a lot of zombie films, but Dawn of the Dead is the most iconic because it has, you know, the sort of critique of commercialism with the zombies, you know, in the shopping mall, going up the escalator and everything.
There's a zombie thing kind of change. It's kind of changed now. It started to become about different ways that there's people could become zombified.
Yeah.
You know, through, and actually you have all these real life stories about drugs that people take.
The bath
and,
salts.
Yeah, yeah, that make them eat the face off other people stuff like that.
That's right, because in like movies like 28 Days Later, it's not a living dead thing, but it's like portrayed like a virus, like a pathogen that...
Yeah, I remember a lot of stories coming out the same time as these news stories about people becoming zombified and the idea of the fact that the, you know, these scenarios where we're going to need the National Guard or a different kind of NATO police force to actually hold back the hordes of people who have just become the living dead for some reason, some kind of toxic poisoning or food additive or some kind of bug or virus they've caught.
What will they think of next?
Indeed. So generalizations, categories, stereotypes can...
be true.
Well, they can be a great thing. I mean, it's really useful to be able to generalize and to be able to make categories about experience and about the world and about things. And, of course, it does, on the other side, cause a lot of problems when people generalize and they're talking about specifics. And a great example of that is a normal person, which doesn't exist, but which is constantly referenced in medicine and by politicians.
Just your average, ordinary, everyday John Doe or Jane Doe. Yeah.
So I think the important thing is to recognize you're using a generalization when you are, but certainly in terms of the movie world.
I suppose that a character is often... a certain look, a certain aesthetic. And it's really a lot of these heroes or these villains are kind of like these archetypal slates that we can project things onto rather than being, you know, a completely fleshed out of character like what you'd get in a novel or something like that. They serve a purpose. There's a reason that, you know, we're attracted to these like mythic type of figures, these more than human type of figures like your John Wick or your samurai type guy or your Western
lawman. We love a label.
Yes. It makes things easier. It's all categories. We put people in categories. We put characters in categories. You know, you've got your good, your bad, and your ugly.
It makes organizing your movie library a bit easier.
Yes.
Easier to find what you want.
That's great. We're some real pretty shit now, man.
You finished.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over. What are we gonna do?
Maybe we could build a fire, sing a couple of songs, huh? Why don't we try that?
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
That's right, folks. Well, we wish you happy viewing with whatever you decide to watch next.
We hope you're enjoying the beautiful autumn weather out there.
Yeah.
And we'll be back soon with some more
discussion.
Yes. Sayonara.
Bye-bye for now.
Tell you to run.
You're listening to People Powered Radio, proudly supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. The Community Broadcasting Foundation resources community-owned and operated media stations just like this one that connect people and tell vital, local stories so that we all enjoy a more vibrant, inclusive Australian culture and healthy democracy. Find out more about our work at cbf.com.au.